The Years of Lyndon Johnson, The Path to Power by Robert A. Caro, Part 3, Continued. If a spotlight was turned on those dams, moreover, the congressman responsible for their construction, the congressman who had pushed for those legal fees, would be caught in its glare. The light had to be turned off. The strategy evolved to do so is contained in a memorandum found in Alvin Wirtz's papers. This memo is unsigned and unaddressed, and its author is unknown. In it, both Wirtz and Johnson are referred to in the third person, though at least one member of Wirtz's staff feels that because of the secretiveness of both men, and because the wording of the memo reflects Johnson's style, these references do not eliminate either Johnson or Wirtz as the possible author of the memo. In any case, the memo reflects, according to all living members of the Wirtz-Johnson camp, the thinking of that camp. To counter the threat of an attack with a counterattack, a savage counterattack, against not only Garner and Roy Miller, but also Sam Rayburn. The writer of the memorandum appreciates the significance of the Carter threat. While the PWA feels that $85,000 was a fair fee, he writes, its disclosure will have the effect of smearing Wirtz. The response should be to let Rayburn know that if the Wirtz fees are to be disclosed, other disclosures will be made. The press will be given something that will be good nationwide publicity. How much Garner, Mrs. Garner, Tully Garner have received from the government over a period of 40 years. That Ed Clark wants to figure up how much he, Sam, has made, traveling expenses, etc., in 25 years. That Everett Looney has figures on how much Roy Miller paid to try to buy the Texas legislature. As significant as the strategy revealed in the memo, the savage attack not only on Garner and Miller, who were used to such accusations, but on Sam Rayburn, who was so proud of his untarnished name, which would no longer be untarnished if it was linked in the press with a figure of approximately $225,000, which would represent, of course, only the standard congressman's salary, but would look bad in the papers, was the care taken in the memo that neither Alvin Wirtz nor Lyndon Johnson should be linked with that strategy. The threat should be delivered to Rayburn by Maury Maverick, the memo states, not by Wirtz. Senator ought to be rather independent in the matter and not be concerned about it. Maury ought to call Sam. Better this way than for Senator to get involved. As for Johnson, the memo goes further in stressing that he had nothing to do with the attacks on Amon Carter that had emanated from Washington. Referring to the pie counter missive, the memo begins, Ickes has replied to Amon Carter, writing a real mean letter, and then hastens to add, Secretary Ickes didn't consult Lyndon, and he didn't know about it. Lyndon Johnson or his advisers may have been directing all-out war on the Garnerites, but the Garnerites were not to know. When it became necessary for either Wirtz or Johnson to get publicly involved with the anti-Garner fight, when it was necessary for some key Texan in Washington to return to Texas and publicly lead the fight, it was Wirtz, always so concerned about the political future of the young man he considered his protege, who dropped his mask and did so. Neither Wirtz's fees nor the information about Garner, Miller, and Rayburn was ever made public, possibly because the memo apparently was written on Friday, April 26th, and Monday, April 29th, was the day on which, with Roosevelt's intervention, the Harmony Agreement was drafted and the telegram signed by Rayburn and Johnson was sent. This most serious threat to Johnson's attempt to keep secret in Texas his role in the Roosevelt campaign died. Amon Carter's newspaper was, moreover, the only newspaper in Texas to make even an attempt to portray Johnson's true significance in the fight. In Washington, his leadership, together, of course, with that of Wirtz, of the fight was an open secret. In Texas, it was just a secret. The only time his name received substantial publicity in Texas was when it appeared on the Harmony telegram along with Rayburn's. And because this telegram was signed by Rayburn, and because it was seen in Texas as a compromise, the appearance of his name in this context did not anger the Garner leaders. And Johnson's refusal to take a public stand against Garner, even while he was peddling his story about the John L. Lewis episode in the right quarters, his success in keeping his name off the two telegrams to Rayburn, and out of the subsequent press coverage of those telegrams, the care taken to keep his name out of the entire 1940 Garner-Roosevelt fight in Texas, Lyndon didn't know about it, paid off. To an astonishing degree, the leaders of the Garner movement never became aware of the true extent of Johnson's role in the fight. Asked years later if, during 1940, Johnson brought any pressure to bear not to have Garner nominated, E.B. Germany replied, "No, as far as I know, he didn't." During 1940, two opposing camps were chosen up in Texas, and deep animosity sprang up between them. But surprisingly little of that animosity spilled over onto Lyndon Johnson, because each side appears to have felt that Johnson was on its side. And after the conventions, when the fight was over, the man who had so carefully stayed out of Texas returned to it for private talks with many of the Garner leaders. Some of these men had had doubts about Lyndon Johnson, but these talks resolved them. The few minor gaps in his fences were mended. George Brown had known that Johnson could do it, talking as conservatively with conservatives as he talked liberally with liberals. That was his leadership, that was his knack. And George Brown was right. He arranged for Johnson to meet in a Houston hotel room with two ultra-conservative, Roosevelt-hating Texas financiers. He went in there, and in an hour he had convinced them he wasn't liberal, Brown would recall. "This is a year of strange politics," said an article in the Austin American-Statesman. "Texas runs into some of its most amazing contradictions and cross-currents. New cleavages threaten a deep and serious break in Texas Democratic solidarity. It is a strange, confused, uncharted field, the field of national politics today." Strange, confused, and uncharted it was, a minefield that could easily have destroyed the political future of anyone attempting to build a future in Texas politics in 1940. But through this field, one man, a novice in statewide politics, picked his way with sure and silent steps. Chapter 31. Campaign Committee. After the Roosevelt-Garner fight in Texas, Lyndon Johnson would always have entree at the White House. But after the fight ended in May 1940, that entree was again restricted. Lyndon Johnson no longer had a reason to see the president. Impatient, after the death of his father and uncle, almost desperately impatient, to move along the route he had mapped out for himself, he had no means of doing so. And then this genius of politics found a way. The way was money. At first again, the money was Herman Brown's. Thanks to the profits from the Marshall Ford Dam and the Corpus Christi Naval Air Station contracts, there was plenty of it. However, in political terms, the most significant aspect of Brown's bankroll was not its size, but its availability for any purpose Johnson specified. George Brown had promised that Lyndon need only tell him when and where I can return at least a portion of the favors. Remember that I am for you, right or wrong, and it makes no difference if I think you are right or wrong. If you want it, I am for it 100%. Most politicians are forced, in mapping out the next step in their careers, to choose a step that can be financed. Johnson did not have this problem. He could concentrate solely on which step would be best for his career. Whatever road he chose, he could be sure it would be paved by money from Brown and Root. Furthermore, the aims of the congressman coincided with those of the corporation. The man with the obsession to build big, knew that the way to build big was through Washington. Influence within the national government was what Herman Brown needed, and influence within that government, political power that reached beyond Texas, was what Lyndon Johnson wanted. Each of them could obtain what he wanted through the other. The most obvious use of readily available money for someone aiming at national political power was in the campaign of the man whose strong hands held the reins of national power in such a firm grip. With the great financial resources of the Republican Party solidly behind the campaign of Wendell Willkie, the president's re-election campaign was in severe financial difficulties, and these difficulties were a prime source of conversation in Washington and of concern to Johnson's New Deal companions. Around him, in conversations in the cloakroom or on the floor of the House, at cocktail parties and dinner parties, swirled talk of campaign funds and of where to get them. Furthermore, Johnson could have adduced from his own recent experience with Roosevelt that the president might not prove ungrateful for campaign contributions. Having already provided such contributions to Roosevelt for a state campaign, it seemed the obvious course, the logical course, for Lyndon Johnson to provide contributions for the president's national campaign, and indeed such men as Charles Marsh suggested this course to him. It was not a suggestion he accepted. No one can know why, but it is possible to list several considerations which may have influenced his decision. In a presidential campaign, he would be only one of many contributors. Considering the scale of contributions from New York and other financial centers of the Northeast, not even one of the biggest. The president's gratitude would be proportionate. Moreover, any tangible power and patronage that might result from Roosevelt's gratitude would be held at Roosevelt's whim, and could be withdrawn at his whim. Independent power could not result from such a situation, any more than if he had accepted the president's offer of the REA post. Using Herman Brown's money in Franklin Roosevelt's campaign would probably not get Lyndon Johnson what he wanted. It was necessary for him to find another way of using it. And he did. One facet of Lyndon Johnson's political genius was already obvious by 1940. His ability to look at an organization and see in it political potentialities that no one else saw, to transform that organization into a political force, and to reap from that transformation personal advantage. He had done this twice before, transforming a social club, the White Stars, and a debating society, the Little Congress, into political forces that he used to further his own ends. Now he was to do it again. This time, the organization was the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Like the Little Congress at the moment when Lyndon Johnson's gaze fell upon it, the committee was a moribund organization. Established in 1882 to assist Democratic candidates for the House of Representatives with services and campaign funds, its usefulness had seldom, if ever, reached a significant level. During the 1930s, under the chairmanship of Patrick Henry Drury, a diminutive, soft-spoken representative from the Virginia Tidewater, even that level had been reduced, for Drury was ill-suited to the role of aggressive fundraiser, not only because of personal considerations. He was every inch a country gentleman, he could never ask anyone for a dime, says a friend, but because of moral and philosophical ones as well. The very concept of the massive use of money in political campaigns was repugnant to him, and as a staunch states writer, he saw dangerous implications for the independence of the nation's elected representatives in the distribution of money through a monolithic central committee. He had therefore decreed that the committee's maximum contribution to a congressman would be $250. Few candidates received even this amount. The dichotomy within the Democratic Party, with its bitterly antagonistic liberal and conservative wings, kept the committee's bank account small. Big contributors were unwilling to provide money which might then be channeled by the committee to candidates with opposing political views. For a wealthy liberal, the idea that his money might help finance the campaign of a conservative Midwest congressman was distasteful, as distasteful as the idea that his money might help a New York liberal was to a wealthy conservative. Drury's lack of enthusiasm for distributing money was especially marked when the distributee was to be a northern liberal. The committee's funds had traditionally come primarily from two sources, contributions from congressmen themselves and handouts from the Democratic National Committee. And during Drury's chairmanship, these sources had slowed to a trickle. For some decades, the committee had requested $100 from each Democratic member of the House to fund its operation. Under Drury, this request had been reduced by 1938 to $25, and when few members honored it, Drury made only a token effort to collect. Democrats who turned to the committee for non-financial help were also likely to be disappointed. Although the committee had a speaker's bureau, headed by E.J. McMillan, the bureau functioned only in non-presidential election years. When a presidential election was taking place, congressmen who telephoned to ask for a cabinet member or other name speaker to appear in their districts found McMillan gone. He was invariably drafted by the National Committee and sent to New York to help in the national campaign. The committee's other staffer was its capable secretary, Victor Hunt Cap Harding, a political scientist from California and one of the House of Representatives' deputy sergeants at arms. During a campaign, Harding would take an office, generally only one room, in the National Press Building at 14th and F Streets, so that he could accept whatever contributions happened to come in without violating the law which forbade the accepting of campaign contributions in a federal building. During campaigns, therefore, when the Congressional Campaign Committee should have been the most active, its office, a dim, green-carpeted room in the basement of the Cannon House office building, was often utterly deserted, a condition which sometimes was only slightly improved, even on the rare occasions when Drew rescheduled a meeting of the committee itself, which consisted of one congressman from each state. More than once, the only persons who bothered to show up were Drury and Harding. In 1940, Democratic congressional candidates were even more desperate than usual for cash. The amounts they needed were, in most cases, small, ridiculously small, not only by the standards of later eras, but in comparison with the amounts spent during the pre-war era in statewide races and in the presidential campaign. The amounts varied greatly. Congressional races in the urban centers of the Northeast could cost tens of thousands of dollars, but in the rest of the nation the situation was far different. In 1928, for example, Ruth Baker Pratt spent $12,000 in her campaign for a House seat from New York City. That was several times the total amount spent that year by all six candidates for the three congressional seats in the state of Oregon. A detailed study of expenditures in House races in that state between 1912 and 1928, the most detailed study available for the pre-war period, showed that of 38 candidates for Congress, only three had spent as much as $3,000. 24 of the 38 had spent less than $1,000. This situation had not changed much in 1938. In that year, the six candidates, three Democrats and three Republicans, for Oregon's three seats, spent a total of $12,987, a little more than $2,000 per candidate. In most other western and midwestern states, the range that year was the same. In the great majority of cases, campaigning for a seat in the House of Representatives is not an expensive business, wrote Louise Overacker, the era's leading academic expert on campaign finance. Discussions with congressmen of that era indicate that most campaigns cost less than $5,000, and their recollections are confirmed by insiders who had an overview of the situation, such as Thomas Corcoran and James Rowe. In politics, says Rowe, $5,000 was a hell of a lot of money in those days. Little as Democratic congressional candidates needed in 1940, however, there was small hope that they would get it from their congressional campaign committee. Because the nation's business community was so overwhelmingly Republican, funds were traditionally in short supply at Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Biltmore Hotel in New York. The party had been outspent by the GOP in every national election since 1920, and the gap had been huge in 1936. Never had the supply of funds been shorter than in 1940. Fueled by rage at Roosevelt and possessed of an attractive candidate to run against him, for the first time since Teddy Roosevelt, said Time, the Republicans had a man they could yell for and mean it. The GOP was gearing up and shelling out for a supreme effort to put its own man in the White House. After the election, a Senate committee would determine the ratio of expenditures between the two parties as almost 2.5 to 1. The Democrats, anxious to put such seasoned speechmakers as Harold Ickes on the air, found that they simply did not have the money to spend on more than a few such nationwide broadcasts. The five great radio speeches by Roosevelt himself that were to boost his popularity during the last days of the campaign would not have been broadcast had not Richard Reynolds, of the North Carolina tobacco family, appeared on the scene with a last-minute $175,000 loan to pay for the radio time. The National Committee needed every dollar it could raise for the presidential race, and was going to be able to spare very little funds indeed for its poor relation in Washington. Even had funds been ample at the Biltmore, there would have been little disposition to divert them to the National Press Building. Farley, bitter at the president he believed had deceived him, resigned in August as chairman of the Democratic National Committee. His replacement, Edward J. Flynn, boss of the Bronx, did not possess Farley's national acquaintance. "I did not know many senators and congressmen," he was to recall. They were aware, moreover, that Flynn's loyalty ran only to the president. "Many of them were suspicious of me and displayed no great enthusiasm over my appointment. They fully realized that the appointment was purely personal on the president's part, and that he had not consulted with them before he made it." Flynn was not particularly enamored of them, either. Attempting to enlist the fundraising help of prominent senators and congressmen, he found that few, if any, were willing to help. tensions could not be eased by the National Committee staff, for it was a new staff brought in by Flynn, and it consisted of men he knew. New York men, unfamiliar with the embattled campaigners from Capitol Hill, and hence not particularly anxious to assist them in their campaigns. For many Democratic congressmen, raising funds of their own was going to be harder in 1940 than ever before. The year 1936, Alexander Hurd has noted in his landmark study of campaign financing, The Costs of Democracy, was a turning point in the history of political party fundraising. The policies and methods of Franklin Roosevelt's first term produced political alignments more along economic class lines than any since the McKinley-Bryan era. Democratic congressmen from large cities, where burgeoning labor unions were expressing their appreciation for pro-labor New Deal policies with lavish campaign contributions, were aided by these new alignments. Other congressmen, and that included most congressmen, were hurt. Once, a congressman from a rural district, or a district that included a small city, had been able to rely on contributions from the district's businessmen. By 1940, these businessmen and their contributions had turned against the New Deal. The outlook had not been particularly bright for congressional Democrats even before campaign finances were included in their calculations. In 1938, the Democrats had lost 82 seats in the House. Since they had gone into that election with an overwhelming congressional majority from the Roosevelt landslide of 1936, they still held a substantial 265-170 margin. But polls early in 1940 showed that about 60 additional Democrats could expect to lose their seats in 1940. And the campaign financial picture added to the gloom. Recent studies had documented the decisive role of money in elections. In one study of 156 state and local elections, all but 11 had been won by the side that reported spending the most money. Politicians had long since reached the same conclusion. Professionals firmly believed that, as Hurd put it, the side with more money has a better chance of winning. In only two of the 20 presidential elections since 1860 had the party which spent less money come out the winner. Those were the elections of 1932 and 1936. The rule had been shattered by the Depression, combined with the extraordinary popularity of Roosevelt. But now the Depression was over, and so apparently was at least some of Roosevelt's popularity, and the old rule could be expected to reassert itself. At the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, in July, Pauls could be heard muttering gloomily about the lack of funds. Some of them turned to Rayburn for help. Nan Wood Honeyman of Portland, Oregon, once the only female member of Congress, had been defeated in 1938 and had learned the necessity of adequate campaign financing. In 1940, she was attempting to win back her seat, and at the convention asked Tommy Corcoran and Rayburn for help. Corcoran, in his breezy, confident way, asked how much it would take, 2, 3, 5 thousand, indicating a willingness to do the necessary. When the amount needed was set at $5,000, Corcoran said he would contribute $2,000, apparently by tapping private sources in New York, and Mrs. Honeyman said she could raise $2,000 herself from local contributions. That left $1,000, and on the last day of the convention, Rayburn, in a conversation at which Johnson was present, agreed to find her some funds. As it turned out, however, he was unable to do so. His hope that the Congressional Campaign Committee would be funded by the National Committee more generously than usual was already dimming. When he attempted to convince Flynn to set aside $100,000 for help in congressional campaigns, the reaction was reserved. He repeated his plea by letter. A great many of these fellows need help, adding, "Let me say to you again how important it is to re-elect a Democratic House. I remember when President Wilson lost the House in 1918, his path was made rather rough by the Republicans investigating everything that had been done." Rayburn then threatened to keep the funds raised by the Congressional Committee separate from the National Committee Treasury and use them for the members of Congress in need of campaign assistance. But the Congressional Committee's lack of fundraising ability made this threat an empty one. No further word came to Portland from Corcoran, whose time and money-raising abilities were, shortly after the convention, assigned to the presidential campaign. And when Mrs. Honeyman contacted Rayburn through an intermediary in Washington, he was forced to reply, in embarrassment, that he would see that she got help when and if there are funds available to the Congressional Campaign Committee. He was forced to give a similar answer to other candidates who asked for assistance. At a dispirited Democratic caucus on the subject of fundraising, the only suggestion Rayburn could make was that congressmen who had ample funds or safe seats should contribute to the campaigns of those of their colleagues who were broke or in danger. But that suggestion would not solve the problem, as Rayburn himself knew even as he made it. But Lyndon Johnson knew how to solve the problem. He himself could provide the party with substantial funds, and he could provide them fast. And he appears to have been able to generalize from his experience with Brown and Root. Leaving the gloomy caucus with Edward Isaac, another young congressman, Johnson said, according to Isaac, "Sam Rayburn's all wet. That isn't the way you raise money for the Democratic Party." Lyndon's idea was to go to the contractors and get the money. He knew more. He knew, in fact, of a source of money that was available only to Sam Rayburn, and that even Sam Rayburn didn't know about. Oil money had long been a factor in politics in the United States. In Texas, oil had come in not long after the century. The Spindletop field on the Gulf Coast, which would eventually prove out at 100 million barrels, one-tenth as much oil as had been produced previously in America, blew in on January 10, 1901. The robber barons who had tapped the oil fields of the Northeast had been using the sale of black gold to purchase politicians for decades before that. The Standard Oil Company, one historian said, did everything possible to the Pennsylvania legislature except refine it. But the new oil fields of the Southwest had, through the first 3 decades of the 20th century, been controlled by the same companies that controlled the old oil fields of the Northeast. With their control of pipelines, markets, and refineries, and the capital needed to explore and drill, they bought out or forced out the discoverers of the Texas fields so thoroughly that in 1930, 75% of the oil in Texas was owned by Standard Oil and its offshoots and rivals, such as Humble, Magnolia, Gulf, and Sun. And the owners of the other 25% had to sell their oil to these companies, who owned the refineries and pipelines, at prices so low that they were effectively prevented from accumulating capital of their own. The companies and the families back of them that poured money into politics in Texas, Gulf Oil, the Mellons, Sun Oil, the Pews, Standard Oil, the Rockefellers, were the same companies and families who had been financing the Republican Party and selected Democrats for decades in Washington and in various states of the Northeast. Their political alliances on the national level had long been made and cemented. But after 1930, there were new sources of oil money, for 1930 was the year of the Great East Texas Pool. The first success among the test wells being poor boyed, drilled on credit, with frequent halts to raise money to go a few hundred feet deeper, by long broke wildcatters in a poverty-stricken area of East Texas, was 8 miles east of Henderson. The oil that gushed out of it on October 6, 1930, splashing down on the rusty drill and on the derrick floor set among the pine trees, was believed to come from an isolated pocket, because the major oil companies had been advised by their geologists that there was little oil in the area. The second well that blew in, 2 months later, was near Kilgore, 13 miles to the north. That must come from an isolated pocket, too, geologists said. At any rate, being so far from the first well, it certainly couldn't have come from the same field. A month later, another well came in near Longview, 12 miles farther north. 3 separate fields, the geologists said. Certainly no one field could be that big. But with the major companies uninterested, hundreds of small oil prospectors, men who had been wildcatting for years, most without success, rushed into the area. They found that East Texas was a poor man's pool, not only because, with the majors not aggressively buying up land, oil leases could be obtained at reasonable prices, but because at 3,500 feet the oil was relatively close to the surface and the drilling was relatively inexpensive. Since the East Texas oil was a high-grade light-gravity oil with little sulfur contamination, it could be even refined cheaply. Some, very few but some, of the wildcatters could refine their own oil and sell it to gasoline companies. By the end of 1931, in some weeks, wells were being sunk at the rate of 1 per hour. And no matter where they drilled, it seemed, not only between Henderson and Longview, but to the north and south, and the east and west, when they reached a depth of about 3,500 feet and took a sampling of the sand, it came up resembling brown sugar. sugar that had been dipped in oil. By 1934, it was apparent that underneath those barren, dried-out cotton fields and miles of stunted pine trees was an ocean of oil more than 45 miles long. By 1935, the East Texas pool was producing more oil than any state had ever produced, more than any nation had ever produced. Spindletop, with its 100 million barrels, had been huge. The East Texas pool had 5 billion barrels, 50 times as much as Spindletop. And it was owned not by the majors, but by the independents. The majors moved in and bought the independents out, of course. Humble alone wound up with 16% of the East Texas pool. By 1938, the majors controlled 80% of the field. But there was a difference. The East Texas field was unprecedentedly huge, and to an extent true of no previous field, it had originally been owned by the Wildcatters, so that this time, when they sold out, they came away rich. The owner of the first well to hit sold out for a relative pittance, but the owners of the second came away with $2 million, the owners of the third with $2.5 million. Some, like Sid Richardson, took their money and put it into other oil fields, in the Panhandle and in West Texas and down near Houston. And some of these fields came in, too, and this time they didn't have to sell out at all. They could keep the profits themselves. There was by this time so much money that even if they had to share it with the majors, what was left over was millions of dollars. Hugh Roy Cullen, for example, brought in the Tom O'Connor Hill in 1934. He had to share it with Humble, but what he was sharing was 500 million barrels. And more independent because they now had financial resources of their own, the new owners no longer had to share on the former disadvantageous terms. More and more often, in fact, they didn't have to share at all. More independent oil fortunes came out of the East Texas field than from any other place in the world, an historian of the industry has written. This was primarily because of the size of the field. Out of the thousands of tracts and town lots, there was something for almost everyone. And because of this, the East Texas field became a point of departure from the old pattern of Texans going, hat in hand, out of the state to solicit funds for expansion and development. H.L. Hunt, for example, built his own pipelines and was soon filling up the tank cars of the Sinclair Oil Company with his own oil. Little awareness of this development existed among even the shrewdest of politicians in Washington. The names of many of the new rich were not even known, and the wealth of others was drastically underestimated. In August 1935, Harold Ickes forwarded to President Roosevelt an interesting document, which Ickes said had been handed to me by a man in the oil game who thought it ought to reach you. It was a list of oil men who had contributed that year to the Democratic National Committee. Most of the contributions were for $1,000 or less, together with a brief description of the contributors. Of one of them, Herman Brown, Brown had begun buying oil leases. The writer says only, "Do not know of him." One, S.W. Richardson, is described as in debt and borrows money to develop leases from Charles Marsh. Of only two names on the list, Clint Murchison and his partner Dudley Golding, is there an awareness of the size of their fortune. Golding and Murchison came into the East Texas field several months after it started with no money, and after a little over 3 years sold out for about $5 million. Neither the author of the document, nor apparently Ickes, had any idea of the true financial circumstances of the men on the list. And this was still the situation in 1940. In part, this was due to the rapidity with which their circumstances had changed. Sid Richardson had indeed long been in debt, but at the time the memo was sent, that description of him was out of date by several years, and several millions of dollars. And in 1937, he hit the Keystone Sands in West Texas. By 1940, his income was close to $2 million a year. But while the politicians had no knowledge of these oil men, the oil men had a deep interest in national politics. They enjoyed many federal favors. The most widely known, of course, was the 27.5% oil depletion allowance, the loophole that, as Theodore H. White was to put it, gives oil millionaires magic exemption from tax burdens that all other citizens must bear, by making 27.5% of their income free from tax. But there were many others, also important in oilmen's bookkeeping, if less known. For example, the law that allowed the immediate writing off of intangible drilling and development costs on successful wells. and the owners were vitally interested in keeping those favors, which were under almost constant attack. Hardly had the Roosevelt administration entered office when Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau, Jr., called the depletion allowances a pure subsidy to a special class of taxpayers that should be eliminated. In 1937, Morgenthau renewed his plea, calling the allowance perhaps the most glaring loophole, and Morgenthau's boss joined in, calling depletion and other loopholes attempts to dodge the payment of taxes. The Wildcatters were concerned with national policy not only because of favor, but because of fear. As oil from the East Texas pool glutted the market and the price of oil plummeted, the industry was in turmoil, and the positions of majors and independents swirled back and forth in confusion. But in general, the Wildcatters feared federal regulation. The occasion of the memo to Roosevelt, and of the donations which it reported, was a bill introduced by the Oklahoma populist Senator Elmer Thomas in 1935, that would have directly regulated the industry. That bill was blocked in favor of Texas Senator Tom Connally's Hot Oil Act, which left the setting of production quotas with the Texas Railroad Commission, a body which would be controlled by the Wildcatters. Protected by the Railroad Commission from the price-cutting practices of the majors, the independents were soon flourishing, but the threat of federal regulation was a constant cloud on an otherwise limitless horizon. They had plenty of money. They needed a way to make it felt in Washington. They needed a path through which the power of their collective purse could be brought to bear on the federal government. Of the members of the federal government, the only one they knew well enough to be comfortable with was Sam Rayburn. Richardson was from Fort Worth, and many other Wildcatters lived in nearby Dallas. Rayburn's district adjoined Dallas, of course, and he had many close friends among the politicians there. On his frequent visits to the city, he had come to know Richardson and some of the other Wildcatters while they were still poor-boying wells, searching for wealth on a shoestring. Becoming rich, other Wildcatters moved to Dallas, the nearest large city, and also the city whose banks first revealed a willingness to finance the Wildcatters' new ventures, and made their headquarters there. Rayburn met these men, too, usually through a pair of old friends who were intimately connected with the Wildcatters, former State Attorney General William McCraw and William Cottrell, the veteran Texas lobbyist. Rayburn actively disliked the old oilmen, the wealthy shareholders in major companies like the Magnolia, whose 6,000-pound flying red horse atop the Magnolia building dominated downtown Dallas, and at night, when it was outlined in 1,162 feet of ruby neon tubing, the plains for 30 miles around. And he disliked the oil company corporate executives and lawyers, the lobbyists. And the feeling was mutual. Traditional oil interests disliked Sam Rayburn as much as the utilities. Attempting to remove him from Congress, they would fruitlessly pour money into his district year after year. But Rayburn liked Sid Richardson, whom he had known for years as a broke young man, and he liked many of Richardson's friends. And when they had asked him for help, he had helped them. They had told him that the Thomas Bill was a device of the big companies to kill off the little fellows like themselves. If they had very recently, thanks to the East Texas pool, graduated out of the little fellow class forever, he did not grasp that fact. He was never to grasp it fully, a fact that was to have grave consequences for the United States in decades to come. The bill was, they said, a device of Wall Street to keep Texans, them, from ever getting a share of their own state's wealth. They should be allowed to handle their own problems until it was proved they couldn't, and since all this oil was in Texas, this seemed like one problem that Texas should definitely be allowed to handle. Roosevelt at the time was working closely with Rayburn on the SEC bill. The president told Ickes, who would, under the proposed legislation, be given the federal regulatory power, "I do not want to cross wires with Sam Rayburn about this matter." And the Thomas bill was tabled. Rayburn was no stranger to the use of money in politics. As Garner's campaign manager, not only in 1940 but in 1932, he had asked for contributions to his friend's campaign and had gotten them. But perhaps because he was uninterested in money himself, when he thought about campaign contributions, he had a tendency to think small. When he thought large, he thought in terms of Texas, and of the kind of Texans who gave large contributions to politicians. And this old money, cotton money and cattle money, was almost entirely Garner money. He knew how much Garner's backers hated Roosevelt, and he knew that in 1940 they were contributing to Wendell Willkie, and that their money would not be available to him. If there was new money in Texas on the same scale as the old, oil money, the wildcatter's money, he had not yet come to understand that fact. Not having even the vaguest notion in 1940 of the extent of the wildcatter's recently acquired wealth, he could not see its potential for politics. The scale of contributions they had made in 1935, a scale calculated largely in the hundreds, $1,000 was a generous contribution, was the scale on which he still thought. And as for using their money on a national scale, the obtaining and distribution of funds to scores of congressmen across the country, what relationship did a task of such a magnitude have with, say, squat, silent, unassuming Sid Richardson, still wandering around Fort Worth in a rumpled suit and living in the same small, shabby bachelor quarters at the Fort Worth Club where he had always lived? Says Richard Bolling, "He thought that his people were little people. He missed the fact that the independents had become giants. He knew they had money, but he had no idea of the extent of the money." Rayburn did not, moreover, understand, perhaps because he was a man who could not be bought, and this reputation, and the fear in which he was held, kept anyone from explaining his position to him, how important he was to the wildcatters, how the protection he had extended to them in the past, and the protection they were hoping he would continue to extend to them in the future, was one of the most significant factors in the accumulation of their wealth. The speaker, according to the unanimous opinion not only of his allies of this period, but of his opponents, had not the slightest idea of the potential of his position for political fundraising for congressmen on a national level. But Lyndon Johnson saw the potential. He appears to have seen it from the beginning. Although no oil had been discovered in his district, a local attorney, Harris Mulaski, had begun representing some of the formerly broke wildcatters who owned wells in East Texas. Johnson went to a lot of trouble cultivating Mulaski in 1938 and 39, although none of Johnson's advisers in the district could figure out why. Henry Morgenthau and the demands of justice had persuaded Franklin Roosevelt that the oil depletion allowance should be reduced or eliminated. It was only Congress which had kept it intact. The administration wanted federal control of Texas oil. It was Congress which kept that control in the hands of Texas. The wildcatter strength in Washington was in Congress, yet these men were not acquainted with many congressmen. The only one they did know well enough to talk to, frankly, to explain their problems to, was Sam Rayburn. Their strength in Washington was, in the final analysis, that one man. Now, as Speaker, Rayburn was the single most powerful congressman. It was in their interest to keep him in power, to keep him Speaker. And that meant keeping the Congress Democratic. Johnson realized that money could be raised in Texas to keep Congress Democratic, and because Johnson realized the stakes involved, he realized that the money available was big money. But campaign contributions from contractors, that is, from all contractors but one, and from the wildcatters would have to be obtained through others. Since they had not previously contributed to the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, an element of uncertainty existed as to whether they could be persuaded to give now. More important, there was an element of uncertainty as to whether they could be persuaded quickly. With the November election day approaching, it would be difficult to get their money in time. Because of Herman Brown, however, Johnson possessed a source of funds, substantial funds, about which there existed neither uncertainty nor delay. He knew that if he could obtain the position he wanted, he would have, instantly at his command, substantial sums of money to use in it. If he were put in charge of the Congressional Campaign Committee, he could guarantee that it would have funds. This book is continued on cassette number 4, side 1.